You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up after more than a year and a half of no public performances, one Wisconsin high school band has started to get back into the swing of things. We'll talk to a Wisconsin band and orchestra teacher about band class during the pandemic. Now, if you haven't officially weighed in on the latest proposals for Wisconsin's legislative maps, you've got a few more days. Governor Evers created a panel last year known as the People's Maps Commission. Last week, it unveiled new geographic boundaries for the state assembly, state senate, and congressional districts. A redistricting expert involved in the process said Republicans would likely retain an advantage, but it would be a smaller majority. That expert said no matter how you carve up the seats, they'll have an edge because Democrats are heavily concentrated in Milwaukee and Madison. Republicans currently hold 61 of 99 seats in the assembly and 21 of 33 in the Senate. You can formally comment on the proposed new maps through Thursday night. You can join in and tell us what you think at 800-642-1234. Did you participate in this process? Have you looked at the proposed maps? Do you have thoughts on how you want to see these maps made now and in future years? Do you worry about the way we draw these lines giving a party an unfair advantage? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Rob Yeblon is an associate professor of law at UW-Madison and a faculty affiliate with the Elections Research Center. He's also a faculty co-director of the State Democracy Research Initiative. Rob, welcome back to the show.
Good to be here, Rob.
Before we start sketching out these People's Maps Commission maps, it's important to note that the legislature are the ones who actually end up drawing the initial draft of the maps. Is there any indication that they're going to take a peek at these and use them?
Well, I mean, I imagine they'll take a peek. I haven't seen any affirmative indication that they intend to use them. And my guess is that this is not what they're planning to go with, given that they've already provided some indication of the factors that they intend to prioritize when they draw the lines. And I think those are somewhat different from the factors that were prioritized by the People's Maps Commission.
Well, let's take those one at a time, starting with the Governor's Commission on this. What were the driving forces that the designers of these maps said helped them draw them out?
Yeah, so they set out several groups of criteria that they intended to apply. And group one, the criteria that they said they gave the highest priority to, are ones that are essentially enshrined in state law. They said they wanted to create districts that are contiguous, compact, and they used some different mathematical measures of compactness while they were drawing the districts, and districts that generally preserved political subdivisions to the extent possible. In other words, kept counties and municipalities intact, and to the extent that it had to split them, tried to split them into as few pieces as it needed to. So that was group one. Group two, they thought about what's called communities of interest. And these are geographic areas or neighborhoods where residents might share common bonds, whether that's economic bonds, cultural bonds, ethnic bonds, or more. Again, trying to keep those communities together where possible. Beyond that, they wanted to go beyond what the law requires in terms of making the populations of these districts be as precisely equal as they could. And then the next step in their process, which they haven't yet adjusted these maps for, is they want to do the best they can to ensure partisan fairness. And so, again, these are draft maps, and I think at the next stage, we may see them take that group four criteria into account more than they have yet.
And partisan fairness was not one of those required by law things you mentioned earlier. There have been a lot of court cases saying, hey, if a map is drawn deliberately to swing things toward one part or the other, we might not like it, but it hasn't been overturned or blocked, right? There's no law against it.
As a matter of federal constitutional law, the Supreme Court has said it's not going to try to constrain partisan gerrymandering. There are some state Supreme Courts where, as a matter of state law, they've put some brakes on the practice. And, you know, there's an issue that may come up in Wisconsin where if there is a deadlock in the legislative process and a court ultimately draws the map, courts themselves are not going to become partisan gerrymanderers, or at least, you know, that's been the expectation. And so even if it is not going to be constrained by the courts when lawmakers draw the act, courts themselves hopefully won't do it.
With these People's Maps Commission maps, as I mentioned at the beginning there's still a Republican tilt on the maps. And there's been an argument all along that because Democrats tend to be concentrated in the bigger cities, even a fairly drawn map is going to have at least somewhat of a Republican lean. Is there something to that?
You know, there is something to that, although it's very interesting. You know, these draft maps, which were initially computer generated, and then the commissioners, my understanding is, went in and made some adjustments based on their local information and the comments that they had received about things like communities of interest. So these maps, even without taking account of any political factors, do have that sort of mild Republican bias, much less than the existing map that we have. And so certainly, you know, the existing map went well beyond what Wisconsin's geography provides for. And I think that these maps give you a closer sense of what you might get based on the geography, where you do have Democratic voters who tend to be concentrated in some of the big cities in the states. But on the flip side, rural voters are concentrated in rural areas, maybe just not to quite the same extent. And so, again, I think that what we may see as the districting, as the People's Maps Commission now goes back and tries to refine their maps a bit, they may see if they can do better on the partisan fairness score without sacrificing some of the geographic criteria. And it wouldn't surprise me if they can come a little bit closer to proportionality than they have.
Talking to Rob Yablon from UW-Madison, looking at Wisconsin's map-making process for the elections of the next 10 years. You can join in with your thoughts or questions at 800-642-1234. Rob, Republicans in the legislature are going to take the lead on drawing maps that they'd have to then send to the governor. What have they said about their priorities in drawing the new lines?
Sure. Well, so, you know, within the past week or so, they passed a joint resolution, basically along party lines, in which they said what they view as the redistricting policy of the state. And very high on their list of criteria was they said that they believe that we ought to try to retain as much as possible the cores of existing districts. In other words, they basically want to use the map that we have as a template, make whatever adjustments you need to make in order to now assure that populations of these districts remain equal. But they want to change as little as possible. And they also talk in their criteria, you know, in addition to the geographic criteria and everything else, they also talk about continuity of representation, which can include essentially incumbency protection. They want to avoid pairing the incumbents that are already in the legislature with one another so that they would have to face off. And again, the People's Maps Commission in their draft maps, they didn't start with the existing map as a template. And I don't think that they have paid any attention yet to avoiding the pairings of incumbents.
That those maps, the existing maps, were drawn 10 years ago with complete Republican control of the governor's office and the legislature. Were the same principles applied then that, hey, we're not going to try to move a lot of people around from district to district?
No, I think that there's a little bit of you know, folks who are questioning the adoption of the criteria this time around because when the Republicans adopted the map in 2011, they were very happy to overhaul the existing districts in order to enhance their partisan advantage. And so now, 10 years later, they are trying to use this ostensibly neutral criteria of retaining cores really as a way to maintain the advantage that they already gave for themselves the last time around.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Jimmy is with us in Valley Junction. Jimmy, hello.
Good afternoon, gents. Yeah, I live in up by East Atoma, in the middle of the state, and I've been switched several times in my voting career. I used to be under Tom Petrie in the 6th, and then I was under Ron Kind in the 3rd, and now they've brought the map way down from Dave Obey's old district, and now I'm in the 7th, and so I feel like I'm being pulled every which way. And I don't know. I mean, that district goes all the way to Lake Superior, so I'm hoping that they develop a map where, like you said, the interests of the area go together instead of such an extreme distance.
Jimmy, thanks for sharing that story. There are people like that in Jimmy's position on sort of contested boundaries between congressional districts. He's switched a couple times now, Rob.
Yeah, I mean, you know, that happens, and that's part of the decennial redistricting process. We do reshuffle the lines, and people sometimes get new representatives. Sometimes they view that as a great opportunity, actually, maybe they were not electing the candidate that they preferred before, and now they have an opportunity to vote for someone who they prefer who might win. With congressional districts, there's an additional issue that I think the caller gets at, which is because those districts have, 700,000 plus people in them, you actually are inevitably going to be combining various communities and often covering a large geographic area. So in the northern part of Wisconsin, because that's a sparsely populated area, it is just inevitable that a large chunk of you know, the northern part of the state is going to be in a congressional district. It's going to encompass a whole range of counties and communities that do have a range of interests. And so though, although you try to avoid splitting communities of interest to the extent you can, often districts will combine a number of discrete communities of interest, and that's just sort of the nature of the beast.
Thanks a lot for that call, Jimmy. At least we'll keep you in Wisconsin this time around. We'll move you out of the state. We're talking about the ongoing debate over Wisconsin's legislative maps with Rob Yablon. He's an associate professor of law at UW-Madison, faculty affiliate at the Elections Research Center, and faculty co-director of the State Democracy Research Initiative. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What's your reaction to the plans put forward, the drafts so far from the People's Maps Commission? What are your biggest worries about Wisconsin's current maps? Do you like the Republican legislative leader's goal of sticking to the boundaries as close as we can to what we have now? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. The conversation continues coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking about Wisconsin's legislative maps. Last week, Governor Evers' maps panel came out with proposals for the state assembly, state senate, and Congress. Under those borders, Republicans would have a smaller advantage in the legislature than under the current maps. The People's Maps Commission is taking public comment on the plans through Thursday night. Lawmakers, Republicans in the assembly and senate will be coming up with their own maps. The governor is expected to veto likely outcomes of that. Rob Yablon is our guest, associate professor of law at UW-Madison, faculty co-director of the State Democracy Research Institute. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you following this story closely? Have you looked at these People's Maps Commission draft maps? What do you want to see come out of all this? Are you frustrated with or happy about the process, the way we do this in Wisconsin? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. As you were mentioning earlier, Rob, lawmakers draw this, the governor signs it or vetoes it, and the most likely outcome is it's going to end up in courts. The big question, which courts?
Right. Well, so, you know, there have been lawsuits filed in federal court and also in the state Supreme Court. And the state Supreme Court has accepted an original action case. And what that likely means is that it's going to be the state Supreme Court that takes the lead here. There is some federal precedent from the U.S. Supreme Court suggesting that federal courts ought to defer to state processes, whether that's the state legislature or state courts, if those state actors are actually proceeding in a timely way. And so if the Wisconsin Supreme Court is able to, in fact, proceed in time to produce a map, they may well be the entity that does it this time around.
Let's go to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Rich is with us in Appleton. Rich, hi.
Good afternoon.
What did you want to bring up, Rich?
Yeah, I have a question. I live, and we just moved here within the last year. I live on the northeast side of Appleton, District 56. If you look at the maps for this area, 56 has just some unbelievable lines. I can't imagine how they came up with them. I actually live closer to the representative for 55 and 57 than I do for the representative for 56. I can drive through 55, 57, and get way down on the southwest side of 56 again. I'm talking several miles. I'm talking 15 miles probably or more. Also, I have a question about what's going to happen now, because I understand District 56 has increased just short of 8,000 residents in 2020 compared to 2010. So how is that going to affect the boundary lines, too, and what's going to happen with 56?
Rich, thanks for the call. I don't know if we have that level of granular detail on those particular districts, but the weird shapes, the weird distances. It happens in these maps, right, Rob?
It does, you know, and I can't say that I'm going to be able to provide great specific answers, although I think that District 56 is one that might kind of wrap around some of the city of Appleton. And So, you know, sometimes you get these strange shapes for legitimate geographic reasons. You want to keep a city together, and that might mean that you have a district surrounding the city that is sort of C-shaped. It's, you know, it's half of the outside area. You know, sometimes you might follow geographic boundaries like rivers or lakes, and that can produce odd shapes. But the more troubling explanation sometimes is gerrymandering. And sometimes we've probably all seen maps of very funny shaped districts, and you wonder why it was done that way. And often the answer is that it was done because the map makers were trying to achieve a specific political result.
Thanks a lot for that call, Rich. We'll go to Dave now in Milwaukee. Dave, hi.
Hey, I appreciate you taking my call. Great discussion. My opinion is that since the district lines as we have them now were drawn at a time of an absolute power grab by the Republicans, and why not? They controlled the governorship and all the house, both houses of the state legislature. But the very fact that that's when this recent, the most recent restructuring of the lines was drawn, and the Republicans of the legislature wanted to not be changed at all, is more than enough information for me to say this needs to be changed, because it's 100%, if not 100%, close enough of gerrymandering. And to say it's anything less than that is just dishonest, and it's just intellectually wrong. Admit what they've done, because they did it at a time where they were able to do it, and they had no shame in doing it.
Dave, thanks for the call. Rob, your thoughts?
Yeah, well, so look, here, you know, in 2011, when there was unified Republican control, they didn't hesitate to really overhaul the maps and make significant changes. A lot of people were shifted from one district to another. And now they're in a position where their gerrymander from 10 years ago was quite successful. And they want to perpetuate that advantage. And so they don't actually have to overhaul the districts again to do that. They've already achieved their goal in significant part. They just want to do more tweaking. And they, you know, can dress that up in what is some ostensibly neutral language about continuity of representation. But I think the callers, you know, has sort of an instinct that is quite common and maybe a correctly cynical one about the reason why suddenly they're embracing continuity. In my academic work, I've actually adopted a term for this. You know, I call this kind of phenomenon gerrylaundering rather than gerrymandering. You know, gerrymandering you often think of as overt manipulation, you know, completely overhauling districts. But sometimes, you know, you can achieve your political advantages by not doing an overhaul, but just by staying the course and suggesting that staying the course is actually a neutral thing, when in reality, given the biases that are built into the existing map, it really isn't a neutral strategy at all.
Thanks for that call. We're talking to Rob Yablon from UW-Madison, looking at redistricting, drawing the political lines for our state assembly, state senate, and our congressional district here in Wisconsin. Let's go back to your calls now. Mike is on the line in Madison. Mike, hello.
Hello. Hi. I'd like to pose a process or an idea to your guest in that when it comes time for redistricting, the party in control can either choose parallel lines of latitude or longitude, with the other two sides being any shape that they choose, with, of course, the Mississippi and the Lake Michigan and Superior being fixed sides. But then they can choose to how best to address these districts in the future. I'm trying to come up with a solution that's a 100, 200-year plan. No matter whether it's the Democrats, Republicans, a Whig party, a Green party in control.
Mike, thanks. Those Whigs are going to make a comeback. Rob, is there such a thing as a really neutral basis that could restrain overt gerrymandering when one party or the other is in control?
Yeah, you know, I appreciate the caller's instinct to try to figure out a more neutral system. And I think the answer is that there are more neutral ways of doing it. You know, concepts like neutrality and fairness are very difficult ones. And it may just be that there is no one single districting arrangement or process that we would all agree is the very most fair. But I think many of us would agree that there are certain processes and outcomes that are quite unfair. And so, you know, I think as we're engaging in redistricting reform, you know, part of the idea, I think, for the governor to create this People's Maps Commission was to create a counterpoint to a legislative process, which in 2011 was quite, you know, overt in its objectives to maximize the Republican advantage and see, well, could we have a process that's more fair? You know, and we can use some of the criteria that are set out explicitly in the state constitution, which are geographic criteria, compactness, maintaining political subdivision boundaries. And let's see if that gives us a map that actually has a less egregious political tilt. And so, you know, that might be an example of a more fair process. Is it the most fair process? Possibly not, but, you know, we have a, you know, we're starting from a very low baseline.
Rob, just half a minute or so left. What are you watching for next in this process?
Well, you know, there are a couple things. Later this week, we are going to see some filings in the state Supreme Court. We may have more parties that are intervening in that litigation. The state Supreme Court asked the parties to say when they think a decision needs to be reached, when do new maps really need to be in place, and that may help give us a timeline for that litigation. We're going to see in the coming weeks revisions from the People's Maps Commission maps, and I think we'll hear more from the legislature as they start to draft maps, and we'll see what those look like. So I think we have a lot to look out for in the weeks ahead.
I'm sure we'll hear from you in the weeks ahead, Rob. Thanks for joining us again.
Great to be with you.
That's Rob Yablon, Associate Professor of Law at UW-Madison, faculty affiliate with the Elections Research Center. We talked to him about the latest on Wisconsin's legislative boundary maps, including the proposed maps drawn up by Governor Evers' redistricting panel. Coming up, it's been a big challenge to hold band class in schools during the pandemic. A Wisconsin high school music teacher joins the show to tell us how the beat has gone on. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a researcher says we can prevent future viral pandemics by taking better care of natural environments. We'll find out why. Now, band class for many students has sounded a lot different over the past year and a half, in part because playing online together doesn't work very well, as you may have discovered if you've tried singing Happy Birthday in an online gathering. For many teachers, including our next guest, that has meant you had to get really creative and maybe get some more audio editing skills, too. Ben Zaber teaches band and orchestra at Rufus King High School in Milwaukee. Ben, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me, Rob.
I understand you just had your first in-person real performance with your students since March of last year for homecoming. How did it feel after so long?
Oh, it felt fantastic, yeah. Thursday was our homecoming. It was our first live performance since March 7th of 2020. So it's been a really long time, and it felt great to get out there and do it again with the students.
Well, I got to say, as a band kid myself back in the day, that was one of the first things I thought of when schools went virtual was, how hard is it going to be to do band class? Can you share some of the challenges, the many challenges that you've had?
Oh, it was just so hard. Like you said, it's absolutely impossible to have more than one student playing at once because there's just like there's latency. No matter which video chat program you're using. So it's impossible to actually play together. And we didn't have a mandate that students had to have their camera on. So it was hard to even like have the feeling that you were playing together sometimes because, you know, like I didn't know what all the students were doing and they didn't know what each other were doing. So we tried to find creative ways to make it work. You know, I would have different students lead the ensemble through so we'd get to hear different parts. It would work if they put a metronome, like if the students put a metronome on and played along, so we would jump around like that. Just a lot of creative things that we had to do.
Yeah, and part of the fun of a music class is making music together in the same place. Were you worried? Did you lose some students who said, you know, this isn't doing it for me?
Yeah, we did. We did lose a number of students, and that's not usually an issue in our program here at King. Normally, we retain pretty much everyone, but we lost a decent number of students just not coming back. And I think it was the year and a half online that really ruined it for them, because like you're completely right that it's the camaraderie and the spirit of community that's a large part of these high school ensembles.
And a part of what you learn in a band class is the first year students learn from the seniors and so on. Have you had some, institutional memory lost along the way?
Oh boy, have we lost some institutional memory. I think every day this fall, we learned something else that we had lost. Like, I just figured out at the start of last week, I'm like, you guys are doing the roll off wrong for the start of each song for marching band. Like, why aren't you guys doing the roll off right? And then it hits me like, wait, none of them know how to do a roll off anymore. And it was so many little things like that. And then, you know, on top of it, with marching band, you really are reliant on the upperclassmen to be your leaders. But the upperclassmen are, they were sophomores when we walked out of the building. So I've put a lot of weight on the shoulders of students who are really just aren't as experienced as, you know, what I'm used to having. But I'll tell you, they certainly stepped up.
Well, I saw some videos, including that homecoming performance, but also you managed, I think, to stitch together some performances. You had the students record on their own and tried to work some audio editing miracles.
Oh, yeah. Let me first say that is not exactly as satisfying as performing in person, either for me or for the kids. But it was kind of all I could, you know, as band directors, we're kind of product focused, you know, like we want something to happen at the end of what we're doing. And so that's all I could think of. And so the kids would record themselves on their phones, playing along with headphones on, playing along with like a backing track. And then they'd submit the videos to me and I'd stitch them together. And so I keep telling the kids, now that we're back in person, the one thing that I miss about the pandemic is that I could fix all their errors.
Well,
I would just edit them out.
So you are back in person with students now, right?
Yep, fully in person.
All right, are you starting to see things coming together again? It's going to be a long road, I imagine, but what kind of bright spots? I hope there are bright spots that you're seeing.
Oh, there are definitely bright spots. You know, sort of each day we get a little better at what we're doing. And like I said, last week, doing homecoming felt pretty normal again, you know. And so there have been a number of those moments over the last few weeks where it's been like, okay, this feels like what King used to feel like, and I'm glad we're back.
Can you give some encouragement to anybody listening anywhere to stick with band or get back into it or encourage their kid back into it, or heck, grownups, pick up that instrument again? What do we get out of these programs?
Well, I mean, I think first of all, you get a way to express yourself, certainly in a different way than you do the rest of the day, whether you're a student or you're an adult. And if you're an adult, there is certainly, wherever you live, I guarantee you, there are community ensembles out there that you can join. You know, and then it also, like, it works for kids, it works your brain in a different way. And I think that's a very important thing for students, you know, like the marching band for homecoming, I make the kids memorize the music. And that's not something that is valued in a lot of education anymore, memorizing things. And so I think that that's incredibly valuable. So I would say to any students who, you know, if you sort of lost your spirit during the last year and a half, that it's not too late to come back. And that all of us as directors would love to have you back.
Well, Ben, I enjoyed watching the videos you had up. Might have gotten something in my eye during them. I don't remember. Best of luck to you and your squad.
Thank you, Rob. I appreciate it. And I appreciate the time today.
That's Ben Zaber. He teaches band and orchestra at Rufus King High School in Milwaukee. He joined us to talk about what band class looked and sounded like since the start of the pandemic. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. This year marks the program's 10th anniversary on WPR. As part of the celebration, we're sharing some of our favorite stories. Here's producer Carl Christensen with a story about finding yourself in the summertime.
The Playboy Club Hotel opened in Lake Geneva in 1960.
As a kid, knocking around the neighborhood with your friends can be a formative time, and the experiences from those years can resonate for decades. Matthew Lewis shares a story about finding his identity. He told it during an Ex Fabula event, a live storytelling organization in Milwaukee.
So I was super happy that the theme tonight was identity, because it's also in the neighborhood that I grew up in. My parents live like two blocks that way. This neighborhood is like a huge part of my identity. So I thought about the times that when I was growing up and what I really loved was my block I grew up on. My block was just really special. Like, we regularly had like block parties. In the summer, I had my crew. So there was my house and my, I'm gonna call her my sister because that's basically what she became. Sister's house was two doors down. Then I had another friend two doors down, another friend. So basically every other house was a friend of mine, and we would knock on each other's doors and come get each other during the summer every day. What was interesting though is that there was my brother's generation, which was like all boys on our block. So they would be in the back playing basketball and doing things they were not supposed to be doing. And then I would be in the front, and I was like weird because everyone had their children spotty by that point. So like my sister was like older than me, but like there was no one in her generation quite yet. So she was like stuck with us because we were the only other people she was allowed to play with. And then there was like my generation, but then I was the only boy, which I didn't think anything of because it was like, oh, like we just all play together and eat grass. And so then came the summer where like my sister was kind of getting to the age where she was like, it's not really cool to like hang out with y'all anymore, which I understood, you know. At that point, I think I was still trying to play like Powerpuff Girls, and she was like, I don't do that anymore. She had made this friend with this girl from across the alley. Now, there's a big difference in blocks. Like, there was my block, and there was 54th Street. No offense to anyone on 54th Street. Y'all just not as lit as 55th Street. But she, once you cross that alley, it's just a different world, you know? And she would come across, and she was just mean, you know? And I was her target. And I remember, like, every time we hung out, she just always had to, like, dig at me. And usually it was around like, why do you always hang out with all the girls? And I was like, because ain't nobody else around, that's why. Also, I was here first. And so I remember one day we were all walking, and she and my sister had gotten pretty cool, but like I had that like innate like little sibling jealousy of like, you're taking the person who I've been used to like spending every day with away from me, and doing so in a way that's pretty like shady to me. And so she asked me again while we were walking up the block. And she was like, why do you hang out with all the girls? And I was like, well, you know, I like it. And, you know, I just fit, you know, like I'm not like a normal boy. And I remember her looking at me and she was like, you're gay? At this time, I'm like 7. So I was like, I don't know what that means, but your face says it's bad. So no. But I remember being really offended and quickly like swallowing everything I had just said so that like she would not blast this any louder than it had become as a moment between us. But it also, like, I remember, like, the rest of the day, I just felt really apart from everybody. So I became really aware that I was, like, the only boy, and that, like, things like playing Little Sally Walk with everyone was, like, not comfortable anymore. It wasn't fun. And so that summer, I remember going in the house a lot, you know, when the doorbell came, I'd be like, no, I'm gonna stay in. Those things that you kind of want to hide from, so it's, like, that difference that everyone keeps pointing out, like, doesn't keep being the thing that sets you apart from everybody. Needless to say, everyone saw what I saw in this girl about 2 months later, and she was no longer allowed in anyone's house or yard. But it was the thing that I kind of carried with me. I identified that first moment. I am, in fact, queer. But every time someone would, like, police that or kind of sense it in me, I remember quickly backing away. So there's never this feeling of me for being in the closet, but always being like, nope, don't claim that word, because once I claim that word, you can officially push me out. But that's my story, so thank you for listening.
Matthew Lewis's story comes to us from Ex Fabula, a storytelling organization in Milwaukee. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Carl Christensen.
Coming up, we take a look at one of the major causes of pandemics and the intersection of climate change and pandemic risk factors. That's next here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. A report from Harvard finds that we're at a higher risk of experiencing another pandemic than we've been in years past. A major cause of pandemic risk is spillover of viruses from wildlife and livestock to people. And things like climate change and habitat disruption can raise that risk. Dr. Aaron Bernstein is the interim director of the Center for Climate, Health, and the Global Environment at Harvard's T.H. Chan School of Public Health, and an assistant professor of pediatrics at Harvard Medical School. He's the lead author of the report of the Scientific Task Force on Preventing Pandemics from the Harvard Global Health Institute. Dr. Bernstein, welcome to Central Time.
Great to be here, Rob.
I don't know if I usually think of pandemic prevention and environment and ecology in the same sentence. Can you connect the dots for us, please?
Yeah, fortunately, the dots aren't too spaced apart. If you look at pandemics like COVID-19, the ones that have happened in the past, and certainly this one, there's some themes that come out pretty clearly. One is, as the intro mentioned, the viruses that cause these pandemics are entering into people, usually from livestock and sometimes via from wild animals into livestock and sometimes directly from wild animals. But that's not just random chance. That's because we're changing how we engage with wildlife. And so when we do things like chop down forests, we may take away a home of some wildlife that may move somewhere and expose us to diseases that turn out to be problematic. A recent example of that was Ebola. And so we see time and again that our risk of pandemics starts with the movement of usually a virus from a wild animal into a person, sometimes via livestock. So if we address those root causes, what's really changing our relationship with these wild animals, we can go a long way to not having to deal with all of the stuff we're dealing with right now.
I want to stay on Ebola for a minute, because I know initially with Ebola and looking at the news reports, I got the sense that people are going out and contracting this disease in the middle of nowhere, in the wildest part of Africa. In fact, it was at the frontiers of development and deforestation in places in Africa. Why does that raise the risk so much?
Well, in that case, Ebola got into people from bats, and we know that bats can be reservoirs for Ebola, just like coronaviruses. And the research that's been done on the most recent big outbreak in Western Equatorial Africa found that bats had been displaced from their usual homes into those parts of Africa because their homes had been chopped down to plant mostly palm trees or palm fruit. And so those bats were essentially forced into closer proximity with people who were living, as you point out, on the edge of forests. And we think actually the first child who was exposed was actually just playing in a tree near a tree where the bats had been roosting. And so we see this time and again, our change to habitats, particularly forests, can really change where and when people get exposed to wildlife.
Are there practices we can change, really specific practices, to reduce that risk of the spillover of that virus from wild species to us?
Yeah. So for us in the United States and for folks in Wisconsin, one might reasonably ask, like, what can we do here that's going to matter to, you know, what's happening in the tropics where these diseases may be most likely to emerge? The first is to hold the people who are importing animal products into the United States from the tropics accountable. The United States, at least on paper, is the largest importer of wild animals in the world. So we're essentially asking folks to go into harm's way to get these animals and bring them to us. We also know that our consumer practices drive deforestation, whether that is for, you know, palm oil, shrimp, a host of other consumer products. And so corporations are recognizing this more and more. They're recognizing it, particularly in the climate standpoint. But it's also an issue for pandemic risk. And that's one of the great twofers here, is that when it comes to protecting forests, particularly in the tropics, you get value for climate change. You also get value for preventing pandemics. And then, of course, you get perhaps the most value for the people who live in those forests, the indigenous people who really, in most cases, are their best guardians.
Talking to Dr. Aaron Bernstein from Harvard's T.H. Chan School of Public Health about a new report on the links between environment, ecosystems, climate change, and pandemic prevention. What role does climate change play in all of this, Dr. Bernstein?
Well, climate essentially changes the rules of the game for life on Earth. So everything that can get out of the heat is running towards the poles. So whether that's animals, plants, And that creates opportunities for spillover to happen. So animals that didn't share habitats before might collide because they're forced to move. But I think the other piece of it, as I was alluding to before, is the critical piece, which is that, you know, we tend to think of forests and forest conservation in silos. We might think of it as a conservation activity to protect the organisms that depend on the forest. We might think of it as a way to take molecules of carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere, which forests do. And interestingly, perhaps least so, to forestalling another pandemic. And when you take those three sets of values, and there are, of course, others, as I alluded to, you realize that forest conservation in the tropics is probably the best deal humanity's ever seen. And let me put some numbers on that. So globally, the world spends about $2 billion on forest conservation in the tropics every year. Now, that sounds like a lot of money until you realize that the administration has proposed spending $3 billion for drugs to fight coronaviruses alone, or the fact that we spend tens of billions of dollars taking care of people with HIV every year in the world. And, you know, HIV is an example of a disease that came from a wild animal to people. So, you know, we're spending relatively little on this. And yet, through some economic work we did, you know, the costs of really making a dent in the spillover risk are on the order of $20 billion a year if you really focus your efforts. And that's just, you know, a pittance to the cost of this one pandemic, which is on the order of $10 trillion. So our salvation comes cheap, especially, again, when we recognize that actions like conservation and, you know, I focus on the tropics, but it goes beyond the tropics, has such compounding value for our health and for climate.
That's a big mindset shift, right? I mean, I think usually we think of, okay, if a new disease comes along, how fast can we get a vaccine? How fast can we come up with a medicinal cure or a treatment? Are you optimistic that we can get into this prevention mindset?
Well, it's really a great point, Rob. I mean, the reason that this task force report came out, the one that was mentioned in the introduction, was that folks started looking at our response to this pandemic and looking at what science has told us time and again about where the risk is. And it looked as if, you know, we were only focusing on after the fact. It would be like you live near an intersection where there's a car crash every week because there's no stoplight, and all this expenditure is on auto repair shops. I mean, that's more or less what we're doing right now. Now, we need those auto repair shops. We desperately need more access to the vaccines that are available. We absolutely need to strengthen health systems in lower middle income countries where there's limited access, but there is no way we're gonna get ourselves out of the fix of pandemic risk through auto body shops and what I would call these post spillover activities. We really need to focus on prevention at the source. And from the task force report, there is now a massive coalition, and this gets to your point, Rob, about our people seeing this differently. For the first time, we have a really deep collaboration between conservation organizations, the organizations that are focused on saving nature, and the health system strengthening organizations, the organizations that are focused on improving health outcomes for people who lack access to healthcare, because everyone now realizes that we get so much more benefit for the investments we make when we think of these together. And there are really exciting examples that are already happening where we're not thinking in silos, where we in fact realize that spending money, a dollar, on health system strengthening in a lower middle income country on conservation is a dollar spent on protecting health and vice versa.
Briefly, people might be excited about this idea now. What would it take to keep that excitement up when COVID is in the rearview mirror?
Unfortunately, COVID hasn't come close to being in the rearview mirror,
right.
And especially in the low and middle income countries. And the other thing is, you know, this is not going to be the last time. And the evidence is clear that these, you know, because we live in a more interconnected world than ever, we've got more people living in cities, pandemic risk is growing over time, potentially. I mean, we can certainly do stuff to try and cut off the risk. But, you know, if COVID has shown us anything, it's that we have a really hard time containing pandemics, even with all the resources that have been brought to bear. So, you know, but let's, you know, I certainly hope that this is in the rearview mirror sooner rather than later. And then the argument is still there, which is that we have recognize that the health of people around the world is entirely relevant to our own through the pandemic. And the money that we spend every year providing, for example, care for patients with HIV or TB or malaria or nutritional programs, all of these programs that we spend in a sort of altruistic sense are actually investments in our own welfare, if for no other means through improving national security and security risks. But we have to, you know, what we need to demonstrate is this twofer, is that when we focus on the health of the people that are receiving care in places where care is not as available as it ought to be, part of that is about protecting the natural world that surrounds them.
And we'll leave it there. Thanks to our guest, Dr. Aaron Bernstein from Harvard. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.